But the next rule of fear is that for every gift it gives, it takes one away. Like a country under attack, the human body has limited resources. The brain must decide what to prioritize and what to neglect. Our muscles become taut and ready. Our body creates its own natural painkillers. But our abilities to reason and perceive our surroundings deteriorate. Cortisol interferes with the part of the brain that handles complex thinking. We suddenly have trouble solving problems, even simple ones, like how to put on a life jacket or unbuckle a seatbelt. All of our senses are profoundly altered. A few of us even go temporarily blind.
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Netta Ulabin. Author Amanda Ripley interviewed hundreds of people who lived through awful disasters, plane crashes, and terrorist attacks, and she wrote a thinking person's manual for getting out alive. It's called The Unthinkable: Who Survives When Disaster Strikes. Ripley is a senior writer for Time magazine who covers risk and homeland security. She says, as a reporter, she was encouraged by stories of regular people who made it out of terrible situations. But she wasn't hearing those stories during official discussions at Homeland Security conferences or congressional hearings. Those discussions were focused on policies, plans, first responders, and not on the ordinary people who often end up saving lives. This reading of The Unthinkable, Who Survives When Disaster Strikes, took place in July 2008 at the Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C.
Thank you very much. So I had written a lot about 9/11 for Time magazine, all the sort of stories you might expect about the terrorists, about the victims, about the victims' families, the widows, what it was like to be a Muslim in New York afterwards. And then I was talking to somebody at Columbia, and she mentioned a study that the CDC had sponsored about behavior inside the towers. And for some reason, that really fascinated me. And I thought, well, that's true. There are 15,000 people who got out of the towers, and what could we learn from them? And it was a rigorous study, a quantitative study, looking at what people had done and not done and why. So I began to look at other disasters, shipwrecks and tornadoes, hurricanes, and I found that people behaved very differently from what we might expect, and yet very similar from one disaster to the next. So it was really, it became more and more obsessive, actually, as I got more and more into it, which is the best way to write a book, right? You have to get a little obsessive-compulsive. So I took a year off from Time and really focused on this. What I found was, instead of being depressing, that the book really gave me a foothold into what I'd been covering for Time. It was a way to say, okay, look, disasters are going to happen. How can we peel away just the fear and try to understand what's going on with our brains, why, and how we can do better? I'm just going to do a little talking and a little reading, and then I'm going to just be quiet. But I want to read to you an example of what I mean, and it's about fear, actually, but it's about the physiology of fear. The scene is February 27th, 1980, which was the day that one of the largest hostage situations happened in history, and it started in Bogota at a party at an embassy, and there were many ambassadors there from around the world. And during this cocktail party, all of a sudden, four well-dressed people come in, two couples, and they open up their jackets and take out guns and start firing at the ceiling. So there's a real sudden contrast. The human fear response looks a lot like the fear response of other animals. So scientists understand fear better than, say, guilt or shame. Fear is so fundamental, says brain expert Joseph Ledoux. There are key environmental triggers that will turn it on and well-worked-out responses that help you cope with it. These things have stuck around through zillions of years of evolution. The first rule of fear is that it's primitive. Consider the fact that our hair stands on end in a terrifying situation. What purpose could that possibly serve? Well, none for us, but scientists believe it may be related to the flashing of feathers in birds or fin extensions in fish, all of which aid in the survival of those creatures. Over the long arc of history, fear has served us very well, and it still does, with some exceptions. Here is how fear moved through U.S. Ambassador Diego Asensio's body. First, an unexpected sound registering 90 decibels or louder sets off an instinctive alarm in human beings. A rifle shot registers around 120 to 155 decibels. As soon as Asensio's ears detected the booming gunshots at the party, before he even realized what they were or that he was afraid, a signal traveled to his brain by way of the auditory nerve, When the signal reached his brainstem, neurons passed along the information to his amygdala, an ancient almond-shaped mass of nuclei located deep within his brain's temporal lobes that's central to the human fear circuit. In response, the amygdala set off a cascading series of changes throughout his body. In a flash, Asensio transformed into survival mode without any conscious decision-making. If he responded like most people, the chemistry of his blood literally changed so that it would be able to coagulate more easily. At the same time, his blood vessels constricted so that he would bleed less if he got hurt. His blood pressure and his heart rate shot up, and a slew of hormones, in particular cortisol and adrenaline, surged through his system, giving his gross motor muscles a sort of bionic boost. But the next rule of fear is that for every gift it gives, it takes one away. Like a country under attack, the human body has limited resources. The brain must decide what to prioritize and what to neglect. Our muscles become taut and ready. Our body creates its own natural painkillers. But our abilities to reason and perceive our surroundings deteriorate. Cortisol interferes with the part of the brain that handles complex thinking. We suddenly have trouble solving problems, even simple ones, like how to put on a life jacket or unbuckle a seatbelt. All of our senses are profoundly altered. A few of us even go temporarily blind. So you can see that everything sort of changes in these situations, which is why we have trouble imagining why a fire drill is important, because it seems so sort of obvious and inane at the time. But your brain works very differently under stress. And one of the most surprising revelations in the book, over and over in every disaster pretty much, is how rare it is to see panic, hysterical panic that you expect. It's very unusual. People in general don't like to see it in a disaster, and they will discourage it. In fact, the bigger problem is that people shut down and stop moving altogether, something called negative panic. And so I got really fascinated with this. Well, what is going on there? There's a reason that we evolved to do this, and what is the reason? It's not simply just shock, you know, or a failure. And then I was interested in why some people do it and others don't. So I'm going to just read to you from a chapter on what I call paralysis, which is this behavior, about one of the worst plane crashes in history. On March 27, 1977, a Pan Am 747 awaiting takeoff at the Tenerife Airport in the Canary Islands was sliced open without warning by a Dutch KLM jet that had come hurtling out of the fog at 160 miles an hour. The collision left twisted metal along with comic books and toothbrushes strewn across a half-mile stretch of tarmac. Everyone on the KLM jet was killed instantly, but many of the Pan Am passengers had survived. They could live if they got up and walked off the fiery plane. Floy Heck, then 70, was sitting on the Pan Am jet between her husband and her friends en route from their California retirement residence to a Mediterranean cruise. When the KLM jet sheared off the top of their plane, the impact did not feel too severe. The Hecks were thrown forward and to the right, but their safety belts held them down. Still, Floy Heck found that she could not speak or move. "My mind was almost blank. I didn't even hear what was going on," she told an Orange County Register reporter years later. But her husband, Paul Heck, 65, reacted immediately. He unbuckled his seatbelt and started towards the exit. "Follow me," he told his wife. Hearing him, Floy snapped out of her daze and followed him through the smoke like a zombie, as she put it. But before they jumped out of a hole in the left side of the craft, she looked back at her friend, Lorraine Larson, who was just sitting there, looking straight ahead, her mouth slightly open, her hands folded in her lap. Like dozens of others, she would die not from the collision, but from the fire that came afterward. At the time of the crash, psychologist Daniel Johnson was working on safety research for McDonnell Douglas. He became fascinated by this paralysis behavior, which had been observed in other plane crashes as well. The Hecks are both deceased now, but a few months after the accident, Johnson interviewed them both. He made an important discovery. Before the crash, Paul had done something unusual. During the long delay before takeoff, he had studied the 747 safety diagram. He even walked around the aircraft with his wife, pointing out the nearest exits, which I'm sure she loved. That's not in the book. He had been in a theater fire as an 8-year-old boy, and ever since, he had always checked for the exits in any unfamiliar environment. Maybe this is a coincidence, but it's also possible that when the planes collided, Heck's brain had the data it needed to make a good decision. The National Transportation Safety Board has found that passengers who read the silly safety information card are less likely to get hurt in an emergency. In a plane crash at Pago Pago 3 years before the Tenerife incident, all but five of the 101 passengers died. All of the survivors reported that they had read the silly safety information cards and listened to the briefing. They exited over the wing while other passengers went towards other, more dangerous, but traditional exits and died. So it's a little dark, okay, I admit. but I found that as anyone who looks at the brain for any or talks to people who look at the brain for any length of time, you become incredibly encouraged by how malleable the brain is. It literally will change in size and shape depending on what you do. If you learn to juggle and do it for a couple weeks, your brain changes. And the same is true with almost anything that you do. Your brain will work elegantly if you give it something to work with. But if it doesn't have a good choice, it might choose a sort of default, not so good choice, which is to shut down and go into a sort of stupor that we know that all animals will do when they are frightened and feel trapped. But I want to end on a more positive note, right? Isn't that what you're supposed to do in these? I want to talk about, again, where I started, which is about regular people and how important it is that we start to focus our national conversation about emergencies and homeland security on the people who matter most, on the number one asset of the country, which is particularly true when it comes to terrorism, which is sometimes more and sometimes less a psychological war as much as a physical war. The thing that we do know is that people do not panic. They become very compliant and obedient. They become very kind to each other. It's not like rush hour on the Beltway at all, which should be reassuring. People need each other in disasters, and they recognize it instantly and instinctively. And there's a lot that we can do knowing that to try to boost our own resilience before something goes wrong. We should stop thinking, I think, about preparedness and go kits and storing water, although that's all good and well. And we should think about resilience and how to make ourselves and our communities and our families and our churches and our schools more resilient. Because you can't prevent all disasters. What you can do is try to increase your odds of recovering from them quickly and well. So, I want to tell you about the story of Grand Bayou, which is near New Orleans in Louisiana. And it's a very unusual place. It's not a high-tech place, but a place we could all learn something from. In 2005, the citizens of Grand Bayou, a remote Louisiana coastal town, had very little advanced technology. What they had were long traditions, close relationships, and a culture of self-sufficiency. For 300 years, this Native American and Cajun fishing community had occupied a treacherous stretch of the Gulf, accessible only by water. Grand Bayou was there before the levees, before the oil tankers, before the National Weather Service. In all that time, Grand Bayou never lost anyone to a hurricane. Rosina Felipe grew up in Grand Bayou. When storms approached, no one waited for an official evacuation order. "We know how to get ourselves out of harm's way, announcement or not," she told me. Residents would talk with one another and decide when it was time to leave. All of them would pile into about 12 oyster fishing and work boats, hitching them together in a long convoy. They'd done it many times before, even when it turned out not to be necessary. Grand Bayou was not an affluent community, but the connections between the people who lived there were strong. "Everyone has family," Felipe says. "If someone didn't want to go, we would make them go." The children of Grand Bayou loved evacuating. It was like a big slumber party. "You're going out on a big old boat ride with all your friends," says Felipe's teenage daughter, Ana Sor Felipe Cortez. Grand Bayou's 125 residents evacuated 2 days before Hurricane Katrina made landfall. That would be before a mandatory evacuation was ordered in New Orleans. Her daughter, her sister's family, along with a few friends, piled into a workboat with her with plenty of provisions. Then they hooked onto the rest of the Grand Bayou convoy and headed out. The trip to a safe harbor took about 2 hours, and no one was left behind. The citizens of Grand Bayou had the resilience to survive Katrina. They had maintained the ties that keep groups strong, the kind of ties many Americans have lost. And now this is the bad news. Over the previous 50 years, builders and oil companies had changed the landscape around Grand Bayou dramatically, destroying the wetlands that normally protected it. The town's residents had noticed this and fought against it for years to no avail. They had elevated their houses above flood level only to see their houses sink again as the development marched on. In 1980, you could walk on land from one house to the next in Grand Bayou. By the end of the 20th century, the land was gone. Grand Bayou, like Venice, was gradually sinking. When Katrina came, it swept all of Grand Bayou away. There was literally nothing left but battered boats and scraps of metal, the ruins of a fine civilization. Since then, Felipe has moved 9 times. Now she lives about 1.5 hours from her old home, hoping to one day go back. Ironically, she is now in more danger than she ever was. The community has scattered across many states, and Felipe and her daughter live in a FEMA trailer. But the citizens of Grand Bayou intend to come back. The first house was finished in July 2007. All of the houses, this is my favorite part, will be soft-billed, simple, cheap, wooden structures that are easy to rebuild. The community is still fighting to restore the wetlands and create a more sustainable civilization. But in the meantime, they plan to evacuate with each storm and then clean up the mess, as they always have. We try to protect life. That's the most important thing, says Felipe. She now thinks that the population of Grand Bayou will be bigger after Katrina than it was before. I know that we're going to survive, she says. We've learned to depend upon each other. And that's the end. So I'd love to hear any questions or comments you may have.
In your research, did you find an unexpected quality among the survivors, something like a sense of humor?
Yeah, it's good that you mentioned that, because it is clear that laughter, like controlled breathing, reduces the fear response. So there's stories of, you know, planes, the pilot announces that there's a problem, and they're going to do a crash landing, and it gets very quiet. Some people might cry or pray, and other people start laughing. Which I would argue is not a terrible response. It's the way of controlling the fear response, which has good effects on your ability to make decisions and move quickly. There's like a zone, like there is for athletes. Like a certain amount of stress improves your performance, but if it gets to be too much, it actually has a dramatic negative effect, and you begin to deteriorate. You lose eye-hand control, you lose cognitive functions, you become a total mess. But, you know, anecdotally, the thing that kept coming up, even when I didn't expect it, was military experience. Over and over again, people had been in these horrendous situations, and they'd be talking about what they did and why, and then they would inevitably say, you know, I guess it's because of the time I spent in Vietnam, or maybe it's from my training in the Air Force or the Marines, and I don't think it was just the skills, really, because often it was happening decades after that. I think it's the mentality, the belief that you can get stuff done, that you should not just think about it, but you should do stuff, and that when someone gives you an order, you shouldn't sort of think about the implications, but you should just go do it. And you see this in small ways. You know, I like to tell the story of fire drills at Time Magazine's D.C. Bureau, where I'm the only one that goes. Although hopefully Maya, our intern, will now come. You better come. And except Vernon, our male guy at the time, he would come too. So it would be me and Vernon. And finally I said to him, young guy, really nice guy, I said, why are you out here? I mean, I know why I'm out here, but nobody else is out here. And he said, I guess this is the time I spent in Iraq, you know? There it was. I didn't know. He was in the Air Force. And he sort of learned that you lose a lot of abilities in a disaster, and it's useful to know where the stairs are and to go down them every so often. It's not that big of a deal. And rather than being weak, it's almost like a masculine ethic, which is really amazing when you think about it. You know, what happens between the military and our regular culture to make that not the same?
The first responder, truly, and you indicated in your book, are the people who are there. And often they respond with kindness. They do things that otherwise they wouldn't even think they could do. What do we do about this problem of the first responder? What would you suggest as an alternative, since the term is taken? The people who are doing all these noble things, what do we call them?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, you hear this from survivors, by the way. I mean, if you talk to them long enough, they'll eventually say this, that, you know, what's their label? Because they really were first. So people have tried, you know, they come up with like zero responder, and there's different. I haven't hit
That's
it.
It's one
yet.
To work on. Okay.
It's one to work on. But I do think another euphemism I've heard lately is volunteers. This is, now, I would argue this is slightly better than just
self-volunteers. They volunteered themselves.
But, like, yeah. So California, which is a model in a lot of these things, compared to the rest of the country anyway, Governor Schwarzenegger recently created a cabinet-level position for the Secretary of Managing Volunteers, because he kept going to these disaster sites, which happens every 5 minutes in California, and being frustrated.
1,000 fires at the present time and counting.
Exactly. Right. See? And he would get frustrated by the fact that all these regular people, some of whom lived there, many of whom lived there, wanted to do things. They wanted to clean up oil spills with their bare hands. I mean, maybe not a great idea, but give them some rubber gloves and you've got a nice resource there. And they were all getting turned away by the contractor who had been tasked with cleaning up the oil spill, and it had nowhere near the manpower to do it, and he just got really frustrated. So they now have a cabinet-level secretary of volunteers, which I would say in a major California earthquake, volunteer is a euphemism for survivor. But, you know, we're getting closer.
What about peer responder or lay responder instead of first responder?
Nice. It's getting better. Yeah.
You alluded to the fact that men and women respond differently to different kinds of acts of events, and I was wondering about the gender differences.
Men do better in certain disasters. Women do better in others, and it has much to do with everything. I wish I could say it's biological or environmental, but you can, of course. So, for example, men are more likely to die in hurricanes and floods and storms of all kind. And that's partly because of the kinds of jobs that they do. They're more likely to be outside. But it's also because they're much more likely to take risks in general. They worry less about almost everything than women do, especially white men, and especially a subset of white men who worry very little about anything that most people worry about. It's about 30% of white men. And so, I don't know. I'll just put that out there. But anyway, so we see that men are less likely to evacuate. And then they're more likely to drive or walk through water, which is how people die in floods. So that's one thing. Now, but on the other hand, because of this, perhaps the same cultural, biological melange, men are also more likely to be heroes. They're more likely to try to rescue people. And you see this over and over again, and there is some data on this as well, that they are more likely, perhaps because there's more expectation that they will, I don't know, to put their lives at risk to help strangers. Women did worse in the Trade Center. But you really drill down as to why, and it's ridiculous things, you know. It's their shoes.
Yeah.
I mean, because they were wearing heels, and if you have to walk down 70 flights of stairs, I mean, that's over an hour. So they took their shoes off and piled them in the stairway, which also led to other injuries. And then they would walk on glass and other things and ended up injured. That. So I think they were 2 to 3 times more likely to get injured. And in many places, they're more likely to die in the tsunami because women didn't know how to swim in a lot of these villages, and men did. So sometimes it was 10x. So, you know, it's kind of all over the place. Thank you very much. Great question.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings and discussions like this one, please visit npr.org/booktour.